Micah.
Chapter 4 tonight. Title of our lesson is The Millennial Reign Predicted. Millennial Reign Predicted. We've looked at the first three chapters of Micah. And in those chapters, we have seen not only that the Lord has pronounced judgment upon Israel and upon Jerusalem, but we also see the reasons why that judgment was pronounced. Because of sin, because of corruption. Last week we looked at the fact that the leaders of Israel were corrupt and how it trickled on down and how judgment was coming upon the nation. I imagine for Micah this was discouraging. Nobody likes to hear that their land or their nation is going to be judged by God. I imagine it was discouraging, maybe even a little bit disheartening. To the people that heard this message and heard these proclamations, I imagine it may have been devastating. Now, some may not even have cared. You know, today that's how we have. You know, there's some people in our world today. You can tell them all about God. You can warn them from the Bible. You can even take the Bible and give it to them. They don't care. I mean, they're living in sin. They don't want to know about God. They don't want to know about the truth. And so, obviously, I'm sure there were some that were not affected. But I imagine there were probably some in Israel that were affected by this message and may have been a little bit discouraged. Well, right in the middle of this book, we have chapters 4 and chapters 5. And what we have, as far as Micah's prophecies, we have a little bit of hope, I guess you say. You know, whenever God, whenever we see the worst in this world, and whenever we see sin, I believe if we look to God, we'll always see some hope there. And we'll always understand that God is merciful, and that God is loving, and that God does care for us. And Micah chapter 4, I believe this chapter really provides the picture, or really provides the teaching of the millennial reign, which is the thousand-year reign of Christ. I believe that will occur after the tribulation. We find the tribulation in Revelation. I believe it takes place in Revelation chapters 6 through Revelation 19. And then you have your thousand-year reign of Christ. Now, in the Revelation, it really doesn't go into detail a whole lot concerning the millennial reign of Christ. It mentions it. It talks about it a little bit. And it gives us enough to know that what will take place and when it will occur. But we don't know all the details of that thousand years. Now, here in this chapter, I believe we do get a little bit more of a glimpse of that thousand-year reign. And notice in verse 1, it says, "But in the last days it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. And many nations shall come, and say, Come, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, and to the house of the God of Jacob, and He will teach us of His ways. We will walk in His paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." Now tonight we're going to really run through this. We're going to cover this entire chapter tonight, as you'll see. And as we go into this, I will tell you right up front, there are many, I'll say a multitude of things concerning the future. I have no understanding or little understanding. What I mean by that is the Bible tells us, and we have to take it as face value. There are some things we may look and say, well, I don't understand how that's going to take place. Well, if God has told us it will take place, we know He'll bring it to pass, and we have to have faith. We may not understand the details or how things will happen, but we know they'll happen. Now, tonight as we get into this, I want you to know is the very first verse. And notice what it says. It says, in the last days. See, that tells us. That phrase, the last days, was used in the book of Daniel. You'll find it in other books of the Bible. That is referring to the last days on earth. It says, in the last days. Obviously, it's not referring to the last days of a certain king of Israel or a kingdom of Israel, or else it would have been mentioned. I believe it's referring to the last days of this world. Basically, the opposite of Genesis 1:1. You know, Genesis 1:1 says, in the beginning. You know, there's going to be an end to what we know as the world today. There's going to be an end to it. There's a beginning. We're in it right now, and someday there'll be an end. And I believe that that's what this is referring to. It says, in the last days, it shall come to pass that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow unto it. So we have here that in the last days, it says, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established. So it's going to take place in the last days. Now that's the closing of time on earth. According to Matthew chapter 24 through 21, there will be a tribulation period on earth. And we know that in Revelation it also teaches that. Daniel chapter 9 verse 27 talks about the 7 years of tribulation. And that's where we get the time or some of the time. I think the 7-year tribulation will take place. And then I believe the millennial reign or the millennial kingdom will be ushered in with Jesus Christ and His full physical return to earth. I also say this, or I also believe this, The millennial reign of Christ will be different than anything that we know today. I mean, I believe salvation as far as salvation by grace and through faith, as far as the scriptures are concerned, salvation's the same in every generation. So I'm not talking about doctrines changing. Doctrines never change. But as far as the way life is on earth, it'll be different than anything we know. And I think as we go through this, we begin to see, as I was studying this out a while back, the more I study about the millennial reign, the more I wish it was now. I mean, it's going to be a nice time because Jesus Christ will be ruling. Now, the end of the Gentile rule on earth will also come to an end. You know, you read in the Bible where it talks about the times of the Gentiles. That's right now, the times of the Gentiles. Paul referred to it. Daniel referred to it. Daniel chapter 2, I believe, is where we find the Daniel 1 and then also Daniel 2 is mentioned. But the times of the Gentiles came in with Nebuchadnezzar. He conquered Babylon, or he conquered Jerusalem, took the Jews to Babylon. And from that point on, the Gentiles have been basically not only the rulers on the earth, but also God's people have been dispersed amongst the Gentiles. And so that's the times of the Gentiles. And we know that'll come to an end as well when Christ reigns on earth. So currently that's where we are. We're not in the thousand-year reign of Christ. You know, there are some who try to tell you that we're in the millennial reign. We're not there yet. We're not in the millennial reign. Obviously, as we go through this, we'll know the reason why we're not in the millennial reign is because it's clear that Christ is not ruling on earth today. As much sin as there is in this world, there's no way Christ is ruling on earth. But anyway, we see it'll take place in the last days. Also, the kingdom, I think, as it says here, will be exalted. It says there in verse 1, it says, "The house of the Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow into it." According to Zechariah chapter 14, if you're taking notes, Zechariah 14 verses 9 and 10, Jerusalem will be the capital city of the millennium. Jerusalem will be elevated above all other cities. It's interesting that Jerusalem has always been a city that many have wanted to conquer, many have wanted to take, and many have wanted to control. It's the same way today. Many want to control Jerusalem. Jerusalem, even though some would say it's in a small, seemingly insignificant spot, it's still, as I've read where one historian said, it's still the center of the world, really, when you think about it. Everything that takes place there affects everyone else because of all that's going on there. Well, according to Zechariah 14, 9 and 10, Jerusalem will be elevated above the other cities. Jerusalem is located on a mountain. And when you read the Gospels, you always read of them, and even in the Old Testament, of people going up to Jerusalem. Maybe that's what this is referring to. It says, "The Lord shall be established in the top of the mountains, and it shall be exalted above the hills." I do believe that Christ's literal reign on earth, I believe he'll reign in Jerusalem. I believe that'll be the capital of the millennial kingdom. Talks here about it being exalted above the hills. And then it mentions, it says, "Many nations shall," or at the end of verse 1, it says, "and people shall flow unto it." And it says, "And many nations shall come and say, come and let us go into the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways. And we will walk in his paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." People will flock, it says, there are there a flow or flock unto the city. I believe this goes back to, if you look at, or not back, but it goes forward to Micah 4:2, where it says, "And many nations shall come." You see, people during this time evidently will willingly go to Jerusalem, not as soldiers looking to conquer this city. You know, that's why people are going to Jerusalem today. They're looking to conquer it, to take it. That's why they've been going to Jerusalem for the past several thousand years, looking to conquer it and to take it and to control it. But evidently, as we look at this chapter, people are going to go to Jerusalem. It says there they're going to flow and all nations are going to go. Notice why. It says, first it says, "into the house of the God of Jacob." Now that's the one and only God, by the way. That's not Allah. That's not any other God on this earth. That's the one and only God, Jehovah, of the Bible. And it says, "And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law shall go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." So, obviously we have Jerusalem being the center of this kingdom. Now, by the way, as you go through this chapter, you know what's interesting? You will not find anywhere in history where you could fit this chapter in. That's another reason why I believe it's prophecy. Because you cannot find anywhere in history where this occurred at Jerusalem, where this has happened at Jerusalem. Not even with a king where you can say, well, maybe it happened with David or with Solomon. As great as those kings were, the nations didn't flow to those kings to learn from them. They didn't go to those kings to be taught and to follow in their ways as far as the world flocking to them. That's not going to happen until Christ reigns upon earth. And so that's another reason why I believe we know this chapter is prophetic. But anyway, it says many nations will bow down. They're going to go up to this mountain. They're going to go up to Jerusalem. And the nations will be moved, so to speak, to unite with God's people. Or if nothing else, to follow the teachings of God. They're going to come to join God's people instead of fighting against them. Which I tell you what, when you think about it, is strange. Ever since the Jews have rejected Jesus Christ, the Jews as a whole through the world have suffered and have been persecuted and been attacked. And it's still that way today. It's going to be opposite at this time. They're going to come and join with God's people. Also, you think of this, there's going to be a time of peace, as we'll see here in a minute, but they'll seek the ways of God. And we find that there mentioned there, He will teach us of His ways, we will walk in His paths, for the law shall go forth of Zion. It says there that they'll seek the ways of God. That tells us that the nations, I'm going to tell you, you're not going to seek the ways of God unless you separate from your evil and wicked ways that you already have. That tells us that the nations, I believe, will leave their idols, their idolatry, their false teachings and their false ways. And by the way, by the time this occurs, keep in mind, I believe by the time this occurs, the world as we know it today is going to be, it's going to be a completely different world. I mean, the tribulation will have already occurred. The believers will already have been raptured and we'll be with the Lord before this even occurs. And so it'll be a different situation as far as the nations coming. But anyway, the nations will leave their idols behind. They'll seek after God, says the God of Jacob. They'll desire after His teachings, which I think is interesting. You know, most political leaders today have nothing to do with Christ. I think the only time they mention Christianity is when they try to get a vote from Christians. That's about it. But usually they have nothing to do with God or the teachings of God. But the nations will seek after God's teachings. You know what we're going to find during the millennial kingdom? There's going to be unity on earth. That's what the Bible's telling us here. There's going to be some unity on earth. Now, real unity in this passage, I believe, is seen because they are serving the correct God. You can't have unity of religions if you have religions all serving different gods and false gods and this God. You can get together, but you're not united. Also, we find, notice what it says there, and I'll read it to you again. It says, and He will teach us of His ways, and we will walk in His paths. Real unity comes when everyone is walking after God and serving God. You know, as a church, we can be united because if we are serving God and walking after God, we can have unity. You know, today there is an attempt to get spiritual unity, but I'll just call it an attempt. Actually, the big name for it is ecumenicalism, and that's basically trying to unite all religions. Began, I believe, for some, not for all, but for some it began as a really neat idea to have fellowship. And some, I don't question their motives, because I believe some probably really wanted to have Christian fellowship. But then there are some, of course, who just wanted to unite everybody and say we're all equal and so forth. And what may have began as a good idea, you know what it's turned into in our world today? It's just a hodgepodge of religion is what it amounts to. I mean, ecumenicalism today includes everybody. I mean, you have Roman Catholics, you have Mormons. Sad to say, you have Baptists in there. You have all different churches, some of non-denomination, all getting together and worship. Now, I have no problem with being, how do you say, peaceful and tolerant with people. But when it comes to worshiping God, how can we worship God with someone who doesn't even believe in the same God we believe? Or how can we worship God if someone doesn't even believe Jesus is God? And that's what you have in a lot of your ecumenical gatherings today. You have religions coming together that really have no business even be together. And so that's not real unity. That's not spiritual unity. That's just that's the world's attempt at trying to unite religions. But what we find here is there's going to be real unity on earth. It says they'll follow God's paths. And I think what we can safely say that God will have ruling power. God will be in control. And God will guide and God will direct. And evidently, God's going to teach at this time. He'll teach people His ways. I believe the Word of God is still going to be valid. I don't believe that the Word of God will ever be set aside. I believe the Bible will still be effective during the millennial reign. I believe people will still learn of God and of His ways from the Word of God. I believe the Word of God is pure and it's God's Word to us. Now, if you notice verses 3 through 7, I believe in this passage we see that the Lord will establish His rule on earth during that time. Verse 3 says, and He shall judge among many people and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war, it says there anymore. But they shall sit every man under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make them afraid. For the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it. For all people will walk, every one in the name of his God, it says there, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. And that day, saith the Lord, will I assemble her that halteth, and I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted. And I will make her that halted a remnant, and her that was cast far off a strong nation. And the Lord shall reign over them in Mount Zion from henceforth, he says, even forever. So verses 3 through 7, we see the Lord will establish his rule, I believe, during this time. First, the Lord's judgment. We find here, he is going to bring judgment. It says verse 6, and he shall judge among many people. You see, the millennial reign, at least the beginning of it, will be a time of judgment. We know according to the book of Matthew that the nations will be judged. The nations that still exist after the tribulation will go before God or before Jesus Christ for judgment. So God will judge on earth. Not only will he reign on earth, but he'll judge on earth. The people and the nations will come before him. And I believe during that 1,000 years, he'll probably act as judge as well. They'll bring issues and everything else concerning problems probably to him. He will be king and judge of his kingdom. Guaranteed judgment will be honest and trustworthy. We don't have to worry about rogue judges during the millennium. Jesus Christ, God, will take care of judgment and everything will be done correctly. And judgment will be final. His decision will be final. Also, it talks about nations. It says they're being judged. It says strong nations will be rebuked. Perhaps the nations of war, maybe the nations that instigated some of the events that took place. Now I say perhaps because I don't know, but maybe that's what it's referring to. Some of the nations that it instigated or that were, major players in what took place during the tribulation. And by the way, when you look at the scriptures, God does not always eliminate nations. You think of Egypt. Egypt, way back in Exodus, Egypt was there. Way back to Genesis, you find Egypt. And Egypt kept God's people, and the Pharaoh was stubborn. We know what took place in the book of Exodus, and eventually God's children were led out of Egypt. Egypt still exists today. God allowed Egypt to continue. See, God will sometimes allow nations to continue. Now, he may humble them in certain ways. We know Egypt has been humbled. I mean, they're nowhere near the power they once were. But God may allow nations to continue, and he says here, strong nations will be rebuked. Maybe it's nations that didn't favor or show favor to Israel during, you know, that's going to be a lot of nations. A lot of nations have turned their back on Israel. Maybe that's what it's referring to. We also find here, he says that weapons will be done away with. It says there, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So swords we beat into plowshares, spears we beat into pruning hooks. By the way, I believe it's the UN that has this verse on there outside their building. I think that's pretty, arrogant to put this out there thinking they can lead in peace. God's the one who's going to bring this about. It's not the UN. It's nobody else going to bring true peace to this world, but it's going to be God. Anyway, we find here that weapons will be done away with, swords will be put in plowshares, spears into pruning hooks. There are going to be no need for weapons of war when Christ reigns on earth. You know, that's a wonderful thought. Have you thought about that? During the millennial kingdom, there will be no war zones. This evening, I imagine this afternoon, if you picked up the paper, or if you got online, you looked at the news, you probably read something about a war somewhere. I believe this afternoon, nations are testing nuclear weapons. There's something going on, you know, somewhere in the world. There's fighting, there's violence, but there'll be no war zones when it comes to in the millennial kingdom. Also, there'll be no gang-infested neighborhoods. You know, tonight, when you leave here, you go home, you know, there are some areas you steer clear of at night because you know, hey, you don't need to be down there. That's where trouble is, and that's where people who live in sin and trouble, you know, during the millennial kingdom, there's not going to be any of that. There will not be the violence like we see in our world today, which that alone is just an encouragement. But anyway, he also talks about peace. It says, nation shall not lift up a sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. So there will be peace to come. It says, nations will cease to fight against each other. They will no longer attack. kill or oppress each other. It says there they'll no longer learn war. Instead, they're going to learn to be peaceful. They're going to walk after God, as we already seen. They'll look to God and His ways. And there's going to be no reason to attack or no reason to defend. When Jesus rules on earth, there'll be no more war. Now, until then, I do believe the Bible teaches we do have a right to defend ourselves. Because Jesus Christ is not reigning right now. And there are vicious people that will oppress, will kill, and murder, and rape, and the list goes on and on and on and on. So I do believe the Bible teaches we have the right to protect ourselves, the right to defend ourselves. I mean, the apostles were told to carry swords. Now, that wasn't so they can just hold on to them so they could look good. That was for defense, so they could take care of themselves as they went out. And so we do have that right. I don't think God expects us to lay down our weapons. Or, you know, there's nothing wrong with having a military force for a country. Nothing wrong with men and women joining the military or armed forces and serving. There's nothing wrong with those things. Keep in mind, this is talking about when Christ rules on earth. And today, I tell you, we know, according to Ephesians chapter 2, that the devil is the prince of the power of the air right now. And so it's a different time, or it will be a different time. People will live in peace during the millennial kingdom. They'll live without fear. They'll abide in peace and security because everyone's going to be seeking after God. You see, peace will not come to our world until Christ's kingdom is established. That's something we can find right here and we can understand. You know, many are attempting to unite the world in peace. I think that's been every president's goal for the past 100 years, to try to bring peace to the world. They try to be the president who's brought peace. Now, lately, it's been trying to be the president who's brought peace to the Middle East, which in effect would bring peace to most of the world. But peace is not going to occur until Christ returns. Now, the Antichrist will bring temporary peace. But I want you to understand that when he brings peace, it'll be on his terms. And it'll be in his wicked ways, and he'll enforce that peace. So it's really not going to be peace. It's just going to be peace that he's established because he's leading and he's in control. There'll not be true peace on earth until Christ rules. And that's something we know. That's something really we can look forward to, because he will bring peace and unity. Now, as far as the Lord's people, notice what it says there. As we look at this passage here, it says there in verse 4, "But they shall sit every man under his vine, under his fig tree. None shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts hath spoken it." Once again, that's talking about a time of peace. They'll not be afraid. They'll be able to live in peace. And then in verse 5, "For all people will walk everyone in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. And that day, saith the Lord, will I assemble her that halteth, and I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted." Now here's some interesting phrases here. And I'm just going to give you my thoughts on these to the best of my understanding. I'll just leave you with it at that. It talks about first, you'll notice it says there, it says, "For all people will walk everyone in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever." You know, I believe all people, I guess you could say, as this verse says, they walk in the name of their God. Depending on who they serve, depending on who they're faithful to. And by the way, many today, some claim, "Well, I don't believe in God." I'll tell you what, atheists have more faith than some Christians. Evolutionists have more faith than some Christians. To believe in evolution, you have to have a lot of faith. And so people have just established their own gods. They may not call it a god, but that's what it is. And this here says, all people walk in the name of their God. You know, there are many that are faithful to their false gods. They worship their false god. They serve their false god. And I will say, I don't question anyone's sincerity. I know some people that are sincerely following a false god. I don't question their sincerity. Matter of fact, I believe there are some that are very sincere in their religion. They pray religiously. They do their works and their service. The problem is they're following a false god. They're following a false way. I don't question their sincerity, but the question is who they're following or what they're following after. You think of this, those that follow after a false god, they depend on their false god. They place false confidence in their false god. But notice what it says. It says there, "For all people will walk everyone in the name of his God, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever." What we have to remember first and foremost is this is a passage written to the Israelites concerning the Israelites. When Micah wrote this, he wasn't talking about the church. He wasn't talking about Christians. He wasn't talking about believers. So he's writing to a nation. And he says there first, he says, "All people will walk everyone in the name of his God." That's referring to the pagans and the Gentiles. And it says, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever. That's saying we as Israelites are going to be faithful to our God, and we'll walk with God forever and ever. You think on this. When someone follows a false god, and this is the best way, from my understanding anyway, this is the best way I can describe it. When someone follows a false god, what happens when they die? Their walk with that god ends. Why? Because that god, whether it's Allah, whether it's the god of Mormonism, or any other false god that people follow after, that god has no power to save them and to give them eternal life after death. If they're following a false god, when they die, they're separated from the God of heaven eternally. And so their walk ends. It's over with. But someone who is walking with God, of course, he's talking to the Israelites, but I believe today as believers, we could probably apply at least this teaching to us. Now, we know we're not the Israelites. We're not applying all of the teaching there, but we can understand this, that those that belong to God, when they walk with God, when we come to the end of our life, what happens? Our walk with God continues because our God is eternal. Our God's not going to let us down. Our God is going to take us with Him, and we'll walk with God forever. Unlike those that follow a false god, we have a future, I guess, is the best way to describe this. And Israel has a future as well. Notice he says there, verse 7, and I will make her that halted a remnant, her that was cast off a strong nation. It says, and the Lord shall reign over them in the Mount Zion from henceforth, even forever. Now, them that halted. I've read a lot of different opinions on this, and I'll just give you my thoughts on this. I believe it's referring to Israel. Once again, we got to keep this in context. He's not writing to the church. He knew nothing about the church. He's not writing to believers. He's writing to the Israelites. That's who this entire book is, to the nation of Israel, to the nation of the northern part of Israel, and then also the southern kingdom of Judea. So that's who this is to. He's saying there, we read verses 6 and 7, he says, I will assemble her that halteth, and I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted. I believe without a doubt this is referring to Israel. That's who, when you think of this entire book, that's who he's driving out of their own land. That's why judgment is coming. They're going to be taken into Assyrian captivity. A few hundred years later, the Jews are going to go into Babylonian captivity. So they're all going to be taken out. They're all going to be driven from their land because of the judgment. And then he goes on to say, I will gather her that is driven out, and her that I have afflicted. You see, I believe here we find a promise from God to the Israelites that God would gather them again. He wouldn't, yes, they were being judged, but he wasn't casting them away. He was going to bring them back, and he was going to bless them, he says, in the land again. So as far as the one that is driven, or the one that halted, I guess we could say that was Israel. Once again, I'll give you my thought on this. Keep in mind that Israelites were the ones who rejected the Savior as a whole, that nation rejected Christ. And when they rejected Christ, they weren't cast away, but they lost the blessings of receiving their king, basically. And of course, God knew all this was going to take place. God was not fooled. And Jesus Christ laid his life down. He's in heaven today. But the nation of Israel really has suffered because of that rejection of Jesus Christ. They have suffered, and they really are still suffering. And really, when you think about it, they did halt. They stopped walking with God with that rejection. When they rejected His Son, and we find many parables of this in the Gospels, when they rejected His Son, they rejected God. And so it just, the relationship kind of ended as a nation. Not cast away forever. Romans 11 tells us that they're not cast away, but they are, in a sense, set aside until God will deal with them again. And that's what we find here, that He will gather them again, and He'll bless them again. Now, verses 8 through 13, that's what it leads into. He says there, and thou, O tower of the flock, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion, unto thee shall it come, even the first dominion, the kingdom shall come to the daughter of Jerusalem. Now, why dost thou cry out aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished? For pangs have taken thee as a woman in travail. Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion, like a woman in travail. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city. Thou shalt dwell in the field. Thou shalt go even to Babylon. There shalt thou be delivered. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemy. So in this passage here, verses 8 through 10, we're talking a little bit about Israel's redemption. Now verses 8 through 13, we're going to talk about Israel and them being delivered. Redemption, that's a wonderful word. Now we talk about redemption as far as salvation. Were redeemed. Israel as a nation would also be redeemed. He says the kingdom shall come unto them. Now, It mentions there, it says, O tower of the flock, the stronghold of the daughter of Zion. What tower he's referring to, I'm not real sure. There's a lot of different opinions on this. But the flock probably refers to Jerusalem or to the Jews as a whole. We do know Jerusalem is God's chosen city. And the Jews are his chosen people. As it goes through this, you'll notice it refers, in verse 9 it says, Now why dost thou cry out aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished? For pangs have taken thee as a woman in travail. I believe this is referring to their future. At the time it was their future. It's already past now, but their future captivity in Babylon. The reason why I say that is, first we find that the difficulties mentioned, he says, is there no king in thee? You know, when the Jews were taken to Babylon, you'll read the account in Daniel chapter 1. When they were taken into Babylon, that's officially when they lost all credibility, really, amongst the world, so to speak. The northern kingdom had already been taken into Assyria, but Jerusalem still was there, and so was Judea. But when they were taken, you know what happened? It was it. I mean, there was no more king in Israel. They had really lost their way as far as the world is concerned. And notice some of the words. They said, Why does I cry aloud? Is there no king in thee? Is thy counselor perished? For pangs have taken thee as a woman in travail. What we find, he's just referring to the difficult times that they would come across or what would occur during their time of captivity. And then he talks about redemption. Notice it says there in verse 10, Be in pain and labor to bring forth, O daughter of Zion. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city. Thou shalt dwell in the field. Thou shalt go even to Babylon. There, he says, shalt thou be delivered. There the Lord shall redeem thee from the hand of thine enemy. So Israel would go into Babylon. And I believe this portion of the scripture has been fulfilled. They would go into Babylon. We do find that account in the book of Daniel. We find it in the other prophets as well, that they went into Babylon. We know that after 70 years of captivity, that they were released. Cyrus allowed them to go home, and the Persians even gave them permission to rebuild their temple and their city. And so they were allowed to go back. But you know what we also find? Many of them didn't go back. Ezra went back, Nehemiah went back, and each time they went back, they took a small group with them. You know, most of the Jews stayed out. Most of them had been dispersed. They didn't want to go back, a lot of them. And that's where we really, when you think about it, even though it's been several thousand years, that's where we find ourselves today. You'll find Jews who are dedicated Jews living all across the world today. And now many of them are going back to Israel. More are going back now in our generation than previous generations. But you'll find that they're still there, but they're dispersed still amongst the Gentile nations. But anyway, God did redeem them. God gave them the land back. They did return, and they had the land when Jesus Christ came down. So this, I believe, prophecy was predicted and also fulfilled. But we're going to close with verses 11 and 13. And notice how it begins in verse 11. He says, Now also many nations are gathered against thee. They say, Let her be defiled. Let our eye look upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, neither understand they his counsel, for he shall gather them, he says, as the sheaves into the floor. Now we have a new passage here. And notice, this changes. It's not referring to Babylon anymore. Babylon's one nation. Notice it says, Now also many nations are gathered against thee. Israel is besieged in this passage here. Jerusalem is besieged, I believe, in this passage here. Many nations are looking and are gathering against Israel. Now, this refers to a new siege. And I believe it refers to a siege that has yet to occur. And the reason why I say it is because the Romans conquered Jerusalem in 70 AD. But that was one nation. They weren't many nations. They were one nation, went in, wiped it out, conquered it. Jerusalem has had one group after another take it, but for the most part, they've been right where they are. I once again believe that we're getting into prophecy again, unfulfilled prophecy, let's put it that way, unfulfilled prophecy. I believe many nations, as it says there, will gather against Israel. And I'm going to give you verses for those taking notes if you want to reference this later. Joel chapter 3. Now wait a minute for those grabbing pen. Joel chapter 3 is where you can find also a reference of this time of the siege of Jerusalem. Joel chapter 3, Zechariah chapters 12 through 14, Zechariah chapters 12 through 14, and Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. In those passages, you'll find, I believe, more detailed information concerning this time. Now, we're not going to take the time ourselves to go read all of that, but you'll find where those reference Israel in the last days being besieged, or the nation, or Jerusalem being besieged. This also, I believe, refers probably to the last battle there we find in the Revelation. You see, the nations will look to take Israel in this passage here. They'll look to take Jerusalem from the Jews. Evidently, they're going to look to defile them. Notice what it says. It says there, but it says, "Let her be defiled, and let our lie look upon Zion." So they're looking to take them, to conquer them, to come in and capture them. And the nations evidently are going to be happy, or they're going to delight in this seemingly certain destruction of Jerusalem. I think what we find, you know, it's interesting, when you begin to put all the prophecies together, you're going to find at the end of the tribulation, Israel really is going to be backed into a corner. They are. They're going to be backed into a corner, and they'll have no help on earth. That's what the Bible teaches, that Israel will have no help on earth, that everybody will either forsake, or nobody will come to their aid. And the Bible teaches that that's when they'll look to their Messiah. That's when they'll look to God. That's when they'll look to Jesus Christ. And that's when they, as the Bible puts it, the nation will be, as a whole, will be saved. That God will bless them. You know, I think it's just so interesting how, you know, I don't know what's going to happen over the next, you know, as far as, I don't know how close we are to the end. But it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, there are many nations today, there are many in our nation today that wouldn't mind turning their back on Israel and just not even helping them out at all and letting them just fend for themselves. And if they got wiped out, would say, oh, it's no big deal. And so I believe really we're going to see that happen, or that it will happen on the earth someday. But notice it says there in verse 12, "But they know not the thoughts of the Lord, neither understand they His counsel, for He shall gather them as the sheaves into the floor." You know what's going to happen? The arrogant, prideful nations of this world, the leaders filled with pride, are all going to go up against Israel. They're all going to gather against Israel. They're all going to encircle Jerusalem. They're all going to attack. They're all going to believe that they're going to conquer. They're going to win. They're going to wipe them out. And they have no idea that God is allowing them to do that, because God is going to allow them to come in so He can bring His judgment upon them. And notice what it says there. It says, "They know not the thoughts of the Lord." You see, that's, you know, a practical thought for us today. Let's be careful of thinking we know what the Lord is thinking. We don't. We know what the Lord has revealed in His Word, but we have no idea what God is thinking. Even as on our own personal life, we don't know what God is thinking. We know what He's revealed to us and how we're to live. But we shouldn't pretend to say, well, I think God is thinking. We don't know what God's thinking. Here, they have no idea. The nations don't know that God is bringing them in, or allowing them to come on in, and that really He's in control of all things. You know, our image up here is of one king standing and the other king on the ground. Have you ever played chess? And if you play against someone who knows how to play chess? I don't know how to play chess. I played against a friend in college who knew how to play chess. And it didn't take me very long to figure out he was just having fun with me, is what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was doing, knew exactly where he was moving things, and I was just having fun. And the entire time he was setting me up. He could have ended the game at any time, but he allowed it to carry on so I could play and have some fun. That's what's going to happen. You know, we're going to have all these men and women who think they have all these brilliant ideas go up against God, and in reality, God is going to be in complete control, and God is going to allow them to move, and they're going to think they're in control. And He will allow them to really come to their destruction in a very prideful and arrogant way. You think of this today. There are many people that are fighting against God. As far as our world today, many people fighting against God. Very arrogant, believing that they're in control, believing that there is no God. You know, I was just reading this week. I don't know if you saw today, the atheists have a new billboard in Times Square. I don't know if anybody saw that new billboard they put up in Times Square. I believe it went up today. And it's got a picture of Santa Claus. I said something like, "Let's keep them merry," and then they got a picture of you know, when I say merry, the M-E-R-R-Y, referring to Merry Christmas, and they got a picture of Jesus. It's just an image of a person hanging on a cross, and they said, "And let's get rid of the myth," and that's hanging in Times Square, and it's becoming a big deal. I read it this afternoon. We have these atheists in our world today, and they are attacking God arrogantly, proudly proclaiming there is no God. I've talked to several atheists, and I know I haven't talked probably to the most intelligent atheists, but the ones I have talked to, when I talk to them and talk to them about God and about believing in God. You know what it comes down to? It basically comes down to, because I said so. That's why there is no God. And that's what they believe. There's nothing else. You know what it tells us in Psalm 14:1? The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. You see, our world really is heading that direction quickly. We're educated as far as the world is concerned, but we're foolish in the eyes of God. And our pride, I think, blinds us. When I say our, I'm talking about the world. The pride of the world blinds them. But in this last days, these nations are going to rush in thinking that they could not be defeated, that they're going to conquer Israel, and God will bless them. Notice in our closing, it says in verse 13, "Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hoofs brass." By the way, those references are references to violence or to fighting, to attacking. He says, "And thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord and their substance unto the Lord," he says, "of the whole earth." Israel will be strengthened in the end. When they turn to Jesus Christ, they'll be challenged, and they will, by God's power, arise, it says there, and thresh. The nations will basically be at their disposal. And they'll do as they wish, and they do as they desire. You know, to me it's interesting, even though Israel is so small, even today, as a nation, they're so small, you know what's always just been so interesting to me is how advanced they are with technology in Israel. Even though it's a small nation, they, and if you look, it's not always just because we helped them out as a nation or someone else helps them out. They have many inventions and many technologies there that have come out of Israel. I believe that's God blessing them in spite of their pride, but God blessing them and allowing them to be sustained. And when the end comes, when the nations come against them, God will allow them to be successful and to be victorious. Now, these are all, I guess you could say, these are all not, of course, literal references. They aren't going to have horns, and they're not going to be running around with hoofs made of brass. They're symbolic is what they are. But I believe that when it occurs, basically what we find is Israel will be strengthened. Now, if that were to happen, say in 2013, then what it means is that Israel will probably have the might and the power with their technology, with their military, with their air force to defend themselves and to be successful against these nations that think they're going to come in and have an easy victory. You know, in closing tonight, Israel will appear to be doomed, but they will find strength in the Lord. You see, with God, all things are possible. And that's what Israel will learn. You know, in the middle of this book, right here, chapter 4, you know, we have all this judgment coming upon them, all these terrible things because of their sin. You know, they deserved it. But God is saying, I am going to bless you. Now, what's interesting is Micah, as he's writing this, he probably had no idea how far off this was. I don't know. Maybe he thought it would happen in a few hundred years or something. But he had no idea what was to come. Like, you know, when you read the prophets, for the most part, none of them had a picture of the church. They didn't know what would take place after Christ would come. Now, everything that they have is accurate and it's true, but they didn't know the time, I guess, in between each one of these. In closing, I know I've given you this illustration before. I'll share it with you again. I believe it's good for us because it helps us to understand, at least for me. It's like looking at a set of mountains in a distance. You can see the peaks, but you can't see the valleys. And from a distance, you can't tell how far one mountain is from the other. You just see a set of mountains there. You see a whole bunch of mountains. You know they're not exactly side by side. You know one's behind another and there's valleys in between. You see, the prophets were able to see the mountaintops. They saw the teachings of course, the Messiah to come. They saw the millennial kingdom. They saw other teachings. But they didn't see some of the valleys in between. And one of the valleys, of course, they did not see was where we are today. And that is the time of some call it the age of grace. Whatever you want to, term you want to use, it's basically the time after Christ has, of course, died, ascended into heaven, and it's the time of the church where he establishes church and churches are to continue to reach until the rapture occurs, and then the next mountaintop will be right there. So that's where we are. I encourage you to read the next chapter. We're going to look at Micah chapter 5. We'll also run through that one in one lesson, and that's, talking about the birth of Christ. That's pretty good timing considering we have Christmas coming up here in the next week and a half, so we'll be looking next week at the birth of Christ. We're going to close with a word of prayer. It's good to see you out tonight, and as far as this week, we have no other activities planned. We do have our Christmas service on Sunday at 11 o'clock. So I encourage you, if you're able to come out early,